Thank you. Be seated. Justice Abbott has had to leave, but he will participate in this. The court is ready to argue from
Mr. Bruce Pretty will present argument for the appellants. Appellants have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This case is before this court by certified questions from the United States Court of Appeals from the Fifth Circuit. Both questions involve Article 16, Section 50 of the Texas Constitution, the Homestead Provision, something near and dear to the hearts of many Texans. The first question is pretty simple. Under the Homestead Provision, if a lender charges closing costs in excess of the 3% cap, but later refunds the overcharge, is the lien held by the lender invalid under the general rule of Section 50C? We clearly believe that the answer is yes, the lien is invalid.
If it is invalid, then in effect you have a forfeiture.
We have something, Your Honor, something pretty bad for the lender, but it is not coextensive with a forfeiture.
Why not?
Because there's no recourse.
Why is it not in effect?
Well, you can call it many things, and it looks, and like I said, it's bad for the lender, but it is not coextensive with the forfeiture.
Well, it is a not coextensive, but if the effect is the same because of no personal recourse, then why shouldn't we treat it as a forfeiture under the cure provision?
Well, you have a lien invalid on a non-recourse note. One of the differences between forfeiture, principal, and interest and a lien being declared invalid on a non-recourse note is most likely the sums paid in up until the date of the lien invalidity the lender would not have to give back. Whereas the forfeiture, the provision is very clear, it's all principal and interest. So the lien invalidity just affects the ability for the lender to compel payment of sums due. The two are not the same at all. The one is the consequence of applying the general rule of 50C, and the other is a consumer protection that's been put in to Section 50A6. We're going to do this a lot. 50A6Q10, the forfeiture provision. There are similar bad things happening to the lender, but they are not the same. If the legislature had intended for this forfeiture provision to apply to lien invalidity, it could have said so. It didn't, and I think the language is very, very clear. Because the loan failed to comply with the constitutional requirements, and that's undisputed, and parties agree with that, then the loan is not a loan described by Section 50A6. That seems clear, too.
You agree, however, that the Constitution does allow the lender to cure a problem such as this?
It allows the lender to cure for the forfeiture remedy. And the forfeiture remedy is in 50A6Q10.
If the cure is allowed, then, in fact, the loan is a valid loan under the Constitution.
There is no forfeiture. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, if there's no, but can they still collect on the loan?
There is no forfeiture, but in this case the lien would be invalid.
I understand there's no forfeiture, but can they then, on a go-forward basis, having cured the constitutional problem with the loan, can they go forward and collect payments?
Not if the lien's not valid.
So this just puts so they cure and they don't have to forfeit the 2 months, but they can't go forward and collect because they can't have a lien.
The effect of the way...
So what you're saying is that they're curing for in the past, but they can't cure for purposes of having a loan that meets constitutional requirements.
That is correct, Your Honor. The text of the forfeiture provision only applies, the cure only applies to the forfeiture remedy. The question that's posed by the Fifth Circuit has nothing to do with forfeiture. It has to do with whether the lien is valid or not. And that particular issue, the forfeiture provision does not speak to. And so if they fail to comply with the constitutional requirements, which they have here, then the lien's invalid.
So your position in this case is that I believe they cured, what, within about 3 months after...
Something like that,
after
yes.
they made the loan. So the lender did not have to forfeit those 3 months of interest and principal that they collected, but because they have no valid lien, they are unable to collect on the balance of the loan, and the consumer walks away.
Well, they do not have to suffer the forfeiture, and that is the forfeiture provision.
Well, no, I understand that, but I'm trying to understand. I understand about the no forfeiture, but that's looking backwards. That's
right.
Looking on what they've already collected. I'm trying to understand what your position is as to the effective cure on a go-forward basis.
They end up with an invalid lien.
And as a result, because they have because they don't have a valid lien, they basically have no muscle, and so the consumer can walk away and not pay the balance of the loan.
Unfortunately for the lender, outcomes that's the stuff of Homestead.
Well, I understand, but is that a yes or no? I'm just trying
yes.
to understand what happens. Yes. So
yes.
In this
the lender is left with the unenviable position of an invalid lien on a non-recourse note. But the lender knew what it was getting.
The borrower could pay off the
didn't
value their credit rating.
Absolutely.
In such a way that they pay it off anyway. Even
absolutely.
It could not be enforced against them.
That is correct. I mean, there's still, if not a legal obligation, there may be a moral obligation. I do not know. But all I know is the lien's gone. And the non-recourse nature, a consumer protection put in the amendment, that buttress with the invalidity of the lien goes to put the lender in a bad position. But that is the stuff of Homestead. I mean, Homestead protections necessarily mean that the lender may suffer pecuniary loss if they do not comply with the law. And in this case, they clearly didn't comply with the constitutional amendment. And in that case...
Isn't it an obligation under the extension of credit to not charge these excessive fees?
Yes, it is.
Well, if it is an obligation under the extension of credit not to charge these excessive fees, then it fits exactly within the cure provision.
Well, if we were seeking forfeiture, we're not.
I thought you did it in the lower court.
In the lower court, we sought forfeiture on a couple of other issues, one of which was, I think, the... issue of paying off unsecured creditors, the issue that this court decided in Stringer. At that point, the Stringer had not been decided, and that was an issue we sought forfeiture.
Well, but
we may have also sought forfeiture on the hazard.
But your statement was not exactly correct.
You're correct, Your Honor.
You sought forfeiture of all the principal and interest in the trial court. Is that correct?
That is correct. But the issue here is not forfeiture. And the issue as framed...
If I understand your argument... There's no connection whatsoever between the cure and the validity of the lien under C.
That's the plain language of Section 50. It's the only way I can read it.
That's your position.
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
If, however, the lender cures and therefore does not forfeit the principal and interest, and it is the forfeiture of all principal and interest under the loan as opposed to dividing, as you were saying, on the go forward, either the looking backward basis or whatever. And as a result, there is no forfeiture, then the principal and interest remains due and owing. Why doesn't that then make the lien valid on a go forward basis?
Because
why do we not then have a loan that does meet the constitutional requirements at that point in time? Because we haven't forfeited the principal and interest, we still have a loan, all requirements have been met. We now, at that point in time, have a loan that meets all the constitutional requirements.
Because as I understand the cases of this court over the last 140 years, that if the requirements of the Constitution are not met when the loan's made, subsequent efforts can't make the lien valid.
Well, we've never had a Section 50 before. For 150 years, we haven't had a Section
50. Well, you haven't had Section 50A6. You've had Section 50A5. You've had the home improvement loan.
I'm talking about the particular
provision. Right. No, this is the home equity amendment is new, but homestead protections are not.
But your opponent says all the cases that you rely on for the proposition that the lien's validity is always judged only at the time of inception, none of those cases involve a situation question, the cure. Is that correct?
They don't involve, well...
Would you say then that the cure thing is unique based on all of the 150 years before foreclosure of lands on homesteads?
Well, I must say that it is a forfeiture provision, not a cure provision. And it is, and if you look at it, it is a consumer protection. It's not an industry safe harbor. It gives the consumers an unusual protection, and that's if the lenders do not comply with the obligations under the extension of credit. They can, with an opportunity to cure, be forced to forfeit the principal and interest. It is clearly a consumer protection. It is not an industry safe harbor. If you want to look at Section 50I, there is a safe harbor there, which says that a lender, it shall be conclusively presumed that the lien is valid if a purchaser of value purchases it at a foreclosure sale and some other requirements are met. The legislature knew how to write a safe harbor if it wanted to. And in this case, it didn't. It just added, and if you read the provision, it is clear. If you look at the context, it is clear. It is a consumer protection. It's not a lien saving.
Are you saying the statute's clear?
On this issue, yeah. There's a lot of things that it's not clear.
The same argument can be made that they could have easily made this clear if they intended it the way you are arguing it, too. I mean, I don't think we can really base our opinion on the clarity of the statute.
Well, Section 50 is pretty clear in my mind. No lien shall ever be valid unless it is a loan described by Section 86. I mean, it's Section 58.
So
I mean, that's clear.
So if we cure and we have a loan, then that meets the description of the Constitution, then we can have a valid lien from that time forward. I mean, that's another clear way of looking at that, isn't it?
Except it cannot be reconciled with the cases.
Well, you've already just answered Judge Baker that none of those cases involve a period of time where there was a cure provision like this homestead provisions.
But there really is not a cure provision. It's a forfeiture provision. It's not a cure provision. It is a consumer protection that's got an incredible remedy for consumers that's tempered by a cure mechanism. It's not a safe harbor for the lenders. Is, in my mind, crystal clear. And so the fact that this provision exists doesn't change 140 years of case law. It doesn't change the cases that when the owner fails to notarize the lien, the lien's invalid, or when the work is done prior to the loan being made, et cetera, et cetera. The case of the homestead jurisprudence in this state is very clear. That the requirements of the Constitution must be met when the loan is made, and that subsequent efforts can't make the lien valid.
Well, we do have a unique situation that the whole 56th section is a constitutional requirement in and of itself.
That is correct.
One that the legislature saw fit to include in the Constitution rather than in a statutory scheme such as mechanics liens.
That is correct. So it would be in the Constitution.
So
it can't be changed.
Why shouldn't we interpret this Constitution as Justice Atkinson suggests that when you cure, you now have a loan that complies, you have a valid loan?
Because the language doesn't say that. Because the what they call the cure provision is the forfeiture provision, 50A6Q10. And that is the consumer, the lender shall forfeit if. And that is not, by its very terms, meant to apply to lien invalidity in any way. And I think that, I mean, with all respects to Justice O'Neill, that is clear.
Your point is a lien is a lien, and a loan is a loan. Forfeiture applies to loans, and they don't apply to liens.
Well, by its very terms, the forfeiture provision does not purport to save the lien. And in fact, right now in the legislature, it's in my reply brief, there's a bill to do exactly that on a going forward basis, to provide a lien saving cure provision under narrow circumstances. And that to me is strong. I mean, that's the strongest evidence I can think of, is that as written, there is no mechanism to save the lien. they don't comply with the constitutional requirements, the lien's invalid. End of story.
Mr. Pretty, there are various provisions in legislation that say a party cannot waive their rights by contract under this provision of the DTPA or the other provisions in various acts. Is there any similar provision here that applies in this context? And if there is not, why wouldn't the contract that the borrower signed saying acceptance of any refund constitutes a waiver of any rights arising out of the overcharge?
There's nothing in the home equity amendment per se that deals with waiver. And that, and the reason for that is very clear, is because waiver and homestead rights just don't go together at all. Homestead protections necessarily mean that they cannot be waived, because if they could be waived, they would be no protections at all. And the case is all the way back to this court in Texas Land versus Blaylock in 1890 held that simply the lender cannot rely upon the waiver of a borrower. And on the waiver issue, it is also clear that whatever the borrower does, he cannot waive his homestead protections. Because if you were to allow that, then the protections would go away.
And, well, and the cases are clear. What if the homestead rights remain, but he just, waived the arguments that you're talking about here, the invalidity of the lien
if you waive the ability to assert the homestead or waive an argument for the homestead, whatever way you want to phrase it, it's the same thing. And if you allow any kind of waiver of homestead provisions, lenders will jump on that in every loan transaction. And when you buy a house and when I buy a house and everyone else buys a house, lenders will require that you waive that and the protections will just go away. So any waiver, whether it's termed a waiver of an argument or a waiver of a basis or a waiver of anything, that just simply can't be because the lenders and their attorneys would be very creative in the ways that they get you and I and the other Texans to waive their homestead provisions. So any way you want to phrase this, it's a waiver of their homestead protections, and homestead protections simply cannot be waived.
Let's look at Q subsection 5. What if at the closing there are 20 documents signed by the owner and the lender hands the 20 documents to the owner and there's one that's just missing? In the copy machine, it wasn't included in the stack by mistake. Under your argument, the lien's invalid.
You're looking at QX10, QX A6Q5. And that is the loan must be made on the condition that the lender, at the time the extension of credit is made, provides the owner of the homestead a copy of all documents signed by the owner related to the extension credit.
And let's say there are 20 documents signed by the owner at closing, and the lender goes to copy them, and one page is missing that the owner signed. And they send it 2 days later. Under your argument, the lien is invalid.
This is a requirement of the Constitution.
That's a yes or no question.
I mean, depending upon the situation, if the Constitution is not complied with, and in your hypothetical, it seems that it's not, although you might be able to argue that closing extends over 2 or 3 days.
That's
maybe
a yes or no.
Under your hypothetical, if you're assuming that the Constitutional requirements are not complied with, yes. I mean, that is, it has to be complied with for the lien to be valid. Any further questions?
No questions. Thank you, counsel. Court has raised your argument for the appellee.
May it please the court, Ms. Sherry Payne will present argument for the appellee.
Ms. Payne, I presume you believe the statute is clear as well. But it's clear your way.
We believe that the statute is, based on the plain reading of the home equity amendment, that you can't reach the result urged by AmeriQuest Mortgage Company, and that is that the extension of credit contained in subsection Q10 refers to the same thing as subsection A6.
Let me posit a hypothetical to you that I believe the opposing counsel has posited in the briefs, and that is, if we read the cure provision to cover everything that you are saying it covers, then what would prevent lenders from violating these sections and just hoping that the buyer doesn't notice, and then if they do notice, they can always cure. So why wouldn't it be a method to get around all these requirements?
I don't think that the lenders have any incentive based on the home equity amendment to try to get around the requirements that are stated in the Texas Constitution.
Under this scenario, let's say a lender said, ha-ha, I'm going to charge 10% origination fee, and you know buyers are pretty unsophisticated, and they're probably not going to notice it. And what's the downside if they notify me 2 years later, we'll just cure it? I mean, I realize it's an outrageous scenario, as the one I posited to opposing counsel was, but isn't that a logical extension of your argument?
I understand. Yeah, well, I understand the question, but in this case, AmeriQuest is the one who discovered the mistake during a routine audit.
But again, under your argument, it wouldn't matter who discovered it. I mean, under this scenario, it wouldn't matter who discovered it. It would be under your argument that they can always cure anything, then a lender who might not be as scrupulous or as honest as your lender could, I mean, the scenario he posits in the briefing could happen. In other words, this clear reading that you're both proposing.
I understand. Yes, I understand. I suppose that could happen, but there's no incentive for the lender to do that. The lender wants to make sure that it complies with the constitutional requirements. The lender wants to make sure that its financial product is not defective. And if the financial product is defective, then the lender needs to have the right to be able to cure, as is permitted under Q10 of the Home Equity Amendment.
The argument that, as I understand Mr. Pretty makes, is that a loan is a loan and a lien is a lien, and the two aren't to be confused, and Chapter 50 of the Constitution doesn't confuse them. It doesn't merge them in any way. It talks about liens and it talks about loans. And historically, we've always said, according to Mr. Pretty, forfeiture deals with the loan, principal and interest, and invalidity of lien is determined by the Constitution. And he says, you know, if you don't want a constitutional lien on this house, you've got to follow these requisites. If you don't follow these requisites, the lien never comes into existence. It's not that it's invalid, it just never comes into existence. And he says, your argument says, now that we've got this new constitutional provision that talks about home equity loans, you're trying to merge the concepts of forfeiture of the loan into sort of a concept that a lien that never comes into existence under constitutional theory actually can be brought into existence subsequently by curing the forfeiture problem with loan. He says you're confusing forfeitures with loan invalidity. Now, what in the language of the Constitution in Chapter 50 permits you now to say, irrespective of whatever the law was when this was all developed, we now mean that a lien is created by, the lien that's created here is not forfeited by a failure to create the lien properly. He says you're merging those terms. What about the language that allows you to do that?
The practical effect of the Texas Constitution of the lien invalidity and forfeiture, I think that you end up at essentially the same place. These are non-recourse notes made by the borrower. So, for example, if the lien is invalid, then the borrower, then the lender has no right of recourse. I think
so. The Congress, I mean, you all saw that going into this. The legislature said, look, you're going to have non-recourse loans. The only way you're going to get to them is by having a valid lien. But to get a valid lien, you've got to follow the following things.
Right.
Now, forfeiture meant that you sacrifice all principal interest. Mr. Free says, well, the legislature says, we're not going to make you have to give back the money they've paid because they still owe you under the note. They still owe you under the note. You just can't go collect if they refuse to pay. But that's a different issue. That's a different issue than whether or not you actually get a lien on the property.
Your Honor, we believe that we did strictly comply with the home equity requirements, thereby giving AmeriQuest a valid lien on the property. He's saying that Section 50A6Q10 is only tied to the loan documents, and therefore if the loan documents don't spell out exactly what was supposed to happen, then the lender effectively forfeits all principal and interest. I don't see anything in Section 50Q10 that says that the extension of credit for the lender's failure to comply with the obligations under the extension of credit is tied solely to the loan documents. Had the legislature intended to tie that section to the loan documents, it could have easily said that. And it did say that in Section 50K7 in the situations dealing with reverse mortgages. In Section 50K7, it says that if the lender fails to comply
with the loan documents, then the lender defaults all principal and interest of the reverse mortgage. There's no similar language in Section 50Q10. So we believe that the importance of the cure provision cannot be overstated. This is the lender's only right of recourse. These are non-recourse loans. So we believe that Section 50A6A through Q include all of the obligations under the extension of credit. And I believe that the Supreme Court recently held that in Stringer versus Syndic Mortgage, where it says that you look at Section 50A6 in its totality to determine what the obligations under the extension of the credit are.
How do you deal with the language, though, in subpart C that says that no LIN shall ever be valid? That seems pretty strong.
It does seem like it's strong language. However, if you go on to read subsection C, which is the centerpiece of the appellant's argument, it says no lien shall ever be valid unless it describes a debt, unless it secures a debt described by this section. This section includes Section 50A6. The appellants would have this court read the home equity amendment to end at Section 50A6E, where it says if you violate the 3% cap, then the lien is held invalid. But I think that the court needs to look at the entire home equity amendment to see what the intent of the legislature is.
When does the lien become valid?
When
does the lien become valid?
We believe that the lien was valid at the inception, at the time it was made, because we believe that AmeriQuest complied with the requirements of the home equity amendment. When AmeriQuest discovered during a routine audit that it had made a $641 error, it immediately refunded the overage to the borrower.
But there was a time when the lien wasn't valid then, is that correct? I mean, you agree with that?
If it wasn't valid, it would have been invalid for only the 2 months. But we don't think that the lien was invalid because...
Was it valid from its inception?
Yeah, we think it was invalid from its inception. And then once the mistake is found and discovered, then the lender gets an opportunity to cure the mistake that was made.
If the lender had never cured, would the lien have been valid then?
I think that the lien still would be valid had the lender not cured, because the borrower, I think under the language, it gives the lender a reasonable opportunity to cure once the mistake is made. So when the error is discovered, I think that both parties, in order to preserve their lien, have the opportunity.
But is there a period of time? If the loan is out of compliance with all the requirements of this section, if it's out of compliance, then during that period of time, before there's a cure, is there a valid lien in place? Because the language you just quoted us is unless it secures a debt described by this section, and you say we have to look at all of it, and we know the loan's not in compliance with this section. So don't we have a period of time where there is no valid lien in place?
I'm not really sure I can go that far, because I think that we...
How can you have a valid lien if you haven't complied with the provisions of the statute, I mean of the Constitution? I understand.
Well,
your argument, I take it, is that once there's a cure, that the cure relates back to the inception of the loan.
That's right.
So that, at that point in time, but don't we... Let's say it had taken 2 years mm-hmm. to determine this error, and then the lender sends the money back and cures. During that two-year period of time, there is no valid lien, is there?
Well, let's assume that the lien was not valid. Once the error was discovered, then the lender would have the opportunity to go back and cure to reestablish the validity
of
the lien.
Well, what's going to happen in terms of lien priority during that period of time? What if I come along and I file a lien against the property too? Am I going to have priority, or are you during that period of time?
I guess it depends on how you interpret the cure provision. I guess it's how you interpret the scope of the obligations that can be cured.
I think that's the question that we're asking. We're concerned about, you're asking us to look at the section in its entirety.
Yes.
And now you're saying that when there's a cure, what it does is it makes the loan in compliance from inception. It relates back. So what, we have a period of time where there wasn't a valid lien, but then when the cure is done, the lien springs up and goes back to the inception, and now we get to treat it like it's, I mean, how does all this work?
Yeah, right. I think that the lien would be of record, so I think that anybody looking at the public records would notice that there was a lien on the property. And perhaps at that point, the new lender, the subsequent lender decides whether it wants to make a lien or have another permitted encumbrance on one's homestead.
Why wouldn't you read this provision as the lien coming into existence as the date of the cure, because that's the first date that you have a loan in compliance? We need help here.
Right, I understand. That can only state what AmeriQuest's position is, and that's that the lien was valid from the inception. And once the If it wasn't valid from its inception, then by the subsequent efforts by the lender 2 months later to bring it into compliance, it then did meet the compliance. It did meet the terms of the home equity amendment at that point.
You're just saying the cure should be like that.
Sure. Do you think there's anything, we're trying to determine the intent behind this provision, the fact that there is no cure provision specifically tied to the validity of the loan provision. We don't have any cure provision specifically tied to that provision. Is that significant?
No cure provisions tied to the loan documents?
No, tied to the provision on whether or not a lien is valid. Section C.
Right. Well, I think that you need to, again, I think you need to read Section C in conjunction with Section 58.6, because this section defines the home equity lien. So if you don't read, if you stop your analysis at Section 50C.
No, I'm just asking if there's any significance that should be placed on the fact that the legislature chose not to include in some Part C something, a specific cure provision related to a lender being able to make an invalid lien valid.
Again, I don't see how you can read Section C in a vacuum.
Well, your opponent says the legislature's working on that,
which may be some indication
that, oops, we missed on that, and we need to protect the lien when we allow a cure. Therefore, mm-hmm. we didn't intend for that at the beginning. So
right,
I'm just asking you if there's any significance that we should give to the fact that there is no cure provision tied to subsection C.
Not surprisingly, I think he is relying on HJ4, which is not law at this point in time. The voters have not approved HJR4, and even if the court wants to go so far as to look at HJR4, it further clarifies the legislature's intent that the lien not become invalid if there is a mistake made at closing. I think that the will of the people is expressed in the current home equity amendment, and that is that the citizens of the state want to be able to tap into their equity of their homes now instead of waiting until the homes are sold. If you adopt the reasoning...
They'd like, sure, as long as there's no recourse, as long as they have no personal liability and there's so many traps there that the lien's hardly ever good, I would think the public would be very happy to vote to put that in the Constitution and take money for it. Now, it just bewilders me that lenders are willing to lend money based on what we've got in our Constitution for this. And this is the particular reason. It is not at all clear in the Constitution that the lien can be somehow brought back if the lender just decides to fix whatever mistakes they made to begin with, when it only refers to the forfeiture as opposed to the lien that's being avoided here.
But if we ignore section the cure provision, then what recourse does the lender ever have? If the cure provision wasn't included in the home equity amendment, then maybe we reach the result propounded by the appellants. But the cure provision was intended to mean something. And I think that the requirements to make a home equity loan are complex and numerous. Therefore, the legislature saw fit to insert a cure provision into the home equity amendment. And I think that it's a good example that you gave, Justice O'Neill, about what happens when one of the loan documents gets caught in the copier machine. Under the appellant's analysis, that it immediately after closing and funding, the lien becomes invalid and the lender has no right of recourse, even though a simple clerical mistake was made. Another example would be, is what if the closing costs exceeded one penny over the over the fee cap provision. Under the appellant scenario, immediately after closing and funding, the entire lien would be invalid. And I don't think that that's what the legislature intended. It clearly intended to include the cure provision in the home equity amendment. And I think, again, that the court in Stringer went on to say that the obligations under the extension of credit are found in Section 60A6QI, which is one of the obligations under the extension of credit. So if one of the obligations under the extension of credit can be found at subsection QI, why can't one of the obligations under the extension of credit also be found at QX? QX must share equal dignity with the rest of the home equity amendment. We can't merely dissect Section QX or Q10 out of the home equity amendment and say it doesn't exist just because it furthers the appellant's argument. QX was intended to mean something, and we believe that the plain meaning of the statute is clear, that the lender, if it fails to comply with its obligations under the extension of credit, then it forfeits all principal and interest. The extension of credit language is also found at Section 50A6, where the obligations are defined.
Well, let me, the premise of that argument is that an invalid lien can later be made valid. And that may be the legislature's intent, as you're saying, but that would be against prior case law regarding homestead. Now, maybe the legislature wanted that effect, but it would be against any sort of jurisprudence we have that an invalid lien can, this type of lien can later be made valid if at its inception it's invalid.
Right, and I think that the appellant's cases rely, all predate the home equity amendment clearly, and all are primarily focused on the M&M lien cases where there wasn't a right, there wasn't a way to cure the problems in those cases. But in this case, there is a way to cure minor defects.
Well, no, many of the cases that opposing counsel cites, they were easily cured. I believe there were some affidavit problems, and they were pretty technical and easily curable problems, but the cases said that an invalid lien cannot be made valid.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd agree that in doing this, the legislature intended to depart from that sort of scenario. And we've got to find that intent to depart from it somehow in the language, and you find it in subsection 10, and opposing counsel finds it in C, the lien shall never be valid. No lien shall ever be valid. Those seem to be conflicting provisions.
It says no lien shall ever be valid unless it describes a debt secured by this section. So I think section 58.6 is a part of the section. So if you read section 58.6 in its entirety,
you would say that unless it secures a debt described by this section, was the legislature's intent to allow an invalid lien to become valid?
If one assumes that the lien was invalid and later became valid, then yes, the section 50C allows the lien to later become valid because it describes a debt secures a debt described by this section. Section 58.6, again, is necessarily a part of this section. One issue that the appellants brought up was the waiver in the security agreement. The security agreement did contain language that the borrower's acceptance of the refund would constitute a waiver of the right to bring this lawsuit. We believe that the security agreement was merely tracking the language of Section 50A6, where it provides that if you do accept an overcharge, then you do waive your right later to bring this cause of action. Assuming that the waiver provision was not in the security agreement, AmeriQuest would still have the right to cure under Section 50A6. If there are not
questions. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Unless it secures a debt described by this section, why can't we read that to mean that once it meets the description in this section, it can be valid. What was the purpose of putting that language in there?
Putting the language that no lien shall ever be valid?
No. Well, I guess what I'm saying is, as I understand counsel's argument, is that you're saying that no lien shall ever be valid, and therefore it cannot be cured later. Therefore,
that is correct.
So an invalid lien can never be made valid. Why can't we read the unless it secures a debt described by this section to mean that even if it's not a debt described by this section because of a what they would call a technicality, once it becomes a debt described by this section, then it can become valid. Why doesn't that qualify?
Because that's not what the Constitution, that's not what the language says. The legislature in 1997 wanted to do home equity lending. They could have done it any number of ways. They could have done a whole new Section 50, whatever. They could have done an entirely different framework. They chose to overlay the home equity lending into the existing framework of homestead protections. And they decided, and there's different bills, they had different ways to do it, but they ended up doing it, having it as just a sixth exception to the general rules against validity of homestead loans, taxes, purchase money, home improvements. And the sixth one is just a loan that meets these requirements, and it lists them, A through Q. And so if it does not meet these requirements, it is not a loan described by A6. Even if 2 months, 6 years, 10 years later, it does meet those requirements. At the time the loan was made, it doesn't. And that is where, whether the lien was created or not, I mean, either the lien's created or it's not. And Justice Enig made a very good point. We're not talking about lien validity at all. We're talking about whether the lien was created or whether it wasn't created. And lien creation cannot be fuzzy. We can't have it, well, we think it was created when it was when the loan was made, although the requirements of the Constitution were not complied with.
Well, you're saying validity has to be measured at inception.
Absolutely, and that's, well, and that's what the consistent jurisprudence of this.
I'm having a hard time seeing that in subsection C. Couldn't the legislature as easily have said that? I mean, it says no lien shall ever be valid unless it secures a debt described by this section, and that doesn't clearly mean to me
well, I guess you just have to go to the cases of this court on A5, for instance, which held that subsequent efforts cannot make a non-existent lien existent. You can't have a springing lien. Either when the loan's made, the lien's created, or it's not. Now, Justice Hankinson's idea that that the lien, that when you cure, then the lien comes into existence, that would be something that the legislature could very well provide, and it may be the best way to resolve.
No, isn't that a way to read this language? That's the problem that we're having.
I do not believe
so. What this letter means, and it says that it shall not be unless it secures a debt. Once you have a cure, you have a debt described by this section.
It's the same language that this court was interpreting when it interpreted all those other cases that held that inception is the key, and you cannot cure. It's the same language. Existed in those cases years ago that when you didn't notarize or...
Which language?
What's that?
Which language are you referring to that you're saying is exactly the same?
50C.
The unless it secures a debt described by this section?
Yes.
That's in the other provisions.
I believe it is. I believe that is, and I can look through the history of the, but I believe that that's been in there for years. And
are you saying that a debt as described by this section can be found in our Constitution before this amendment was made in 1997?
I'll have to go back, though. Let me see.
Well, that's critical to your argument, isn't it? That it has to be
yes.
Valid at inception or never.
Yes. And what they mean by section, they mean Section A, which the exceptions to the general rule of invalidity are contained in Section A, and they are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. And yes, the previous version of Section 50 said exactly that. No mortgage, deed, trust deed, or other lien on the homestead shall ever be valid except for a debt described by this section. It's the exact same language that's been there for a number of years. I don't know exactly how many years, but the previous version.
Would you agree that we are limited to looking at number 6? That's the section that this loan was made in, because
right.
It's a home equity loan.
Right. And so the question is, is the loan a debt described by that section?
All right.
And if they don't comply with the 3%
cap. Would you agree with the fact that parts A through Q define what an extension of credit is under part 6?
A6, absolutely.
And that also includes Q10.
That is correct.
Okay.
But Q10, again, is a consumer protection, not an industry safe harbor. Any further questions?
Thank you, counsel. That concludes today's argument. Mark for adjournment court.
All rise.